So last time, we started the discussion about solutions of the classical Dirac equation. So when we quantize our theory, we'll see that part of the quantum field involves classical spinners. And so we need to understand their properties. So because the solution of the classical Dirac equation is also a solution of Klein-Gordon equation, there are two types of solution, the positive frequency solution and the negative frequency solution. Let's look at the positive frequency solution in detail. So here P refers to the momentum. Let's just keep that covariant. So we have some spinner in momentum space U of P. And because they satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation, there's a plane wave part. And we are taking the zeroth component of the forward momentum to be positive. So if you plug this into the Dirac equation, then the Dirac equation implies so where U1 and U2 are the upper and the lower or the left-handed and the right-handed part of the Dirac spinner. So these equations break up into two smaller equations. Which relate U2 to U1. Because our theory is Lorentz invariant, we can solve these equations in some particular reference frame and then boost to find solutions in any other reference frame. So let's take our forward momentum to be the momentum of a particle at rest. Let's call that P0, and then these equations become just simply and then we choose a normalization like this, where Xi satisfies this condition. We can choose this. So U of P then has the form so Xi has 2 degrees of freedom. So it's either, you can choose this to be either this guy or this guy, corresponding to spin up or spin down. So now you can boost, this should be P0. You can boost P0 to some arbitrary value P, then the corresponding, you know, using that there would be a corresponding transformation on your spinner. We arrive at the most general form of U. Note that we are taking the square root of matrices here. And then u bar of p is then defined in the usual way. That is the Dirac conjugate. Now, using the fact that we have this identity, using some sigma matrix identity, you can show that the inner product of u bar with u is indeed Lorentz invariant. Now, because Xi has two linearly independent components, we can label those linearly independent components by Xi1 and Xi2 and choose that they are orthonormal to each other. So then the normalization condition for the spinners become, so they become labeled by the same label as the Xi's. Now, if you work out what the contraction of u dagger, what the inner product of u dagger and u is, then you find that it's orthonormal but not invariant. So if you omit the gamma zero here, okay, from now on I'm going to just not bother to write the brackets. And you need this kind of identities to do computations in quantum field theory. So now, similarly, we can ask what happens if we take the negative frequency solutions. So the negative frequency solutions have the form some spinner, which we are going to write as V of P. And the plane wave part now has a plus sign, where P0 is again positive. Historically, these were associated, interpret as the wave function of antiparticles or negative energy solution, but now we know better, so we call them negative frequency solutions. And then you can go through the same procedure and find a solution for V. And because of the flip in the sign over here, you find that there's a relative minus sign. So where etas satisfy this relationship. Again, we have this guy, but now there's a minus sign here. Let me write that minus sign prominently. But if you forget, if you don't include the gamma zero, we still get a plus sign of EP. This is not relativistically invariant. So for some of the calculations that I will leave as exercise, you'll need the following identity, so I'm just going to list them. So this should be intuitively clear that if you take the inner product of U with V, or the inner product of V bar, sorry, with U, that should give you zero. However, in general, if you take U dagger of P and V of P, this thing does not vanish. So this thing actually does not vanish. And similarly, if you take it's not important what its value is, but it does not vanish. But I wanted to contrast that with the case where if you take the U dagger and look at its three momentum part and set that to minus of the three momentum part of V of R. So I'm emphasizing that the sign of the three momentum parts are opposite by using the underbar, then that thing is zero. And similarly, V dagger of S minus P U of R of P is zero. So this becomes useful when you're trying to do some of the operator, trying to work out some of the operator identities. So, in calculating cross sections, the beam that we usually consider is unpolarized. And so, you know, we have to actually average over the initial spins of fermions coming into some, you know, collider experiment. And then a lot of times our detectors do not distinguish, you know, whether the particle coming in has spin up or spin down. So then we have to sum over this final polarizations. So which means that we have to consider spin sums. And the spin sums are given by, if you take the outer product of a spinner and its conjugate spinner, so it should be S. So this is a 4x4 matrix because here I have a column matrix, here I have a row matrix. Then using your sigma matrix properties, you can show that this gives you, or in other words, P slash plus, where P slash, as usual, is this thing. So similarly, if you take the sum over the V spinners, get something similar. You get P slash minus. So you can think of the right-hand sides as proportional to a projection operator which projects onto the positive frequency parts and the negative frequency parts. So we now have all the ingredients to write the most general classical solution to the free Dirac equation. And we just sum over those positive and the negative frequency part. We do a Fourier integral. We sum over all the spin states. They're two independent ones. Sometimes I will denote three vector P. Sometimes I'll forget that, because in most of these applications, we are considering our momentum to satisfy the Machel condition. So the EK, sorry, this should be K. So the EK is determined by, by the three-dimensional part. So it'll be something like M squared K squared. And then these are the Fourier coefficients. This is the negative solution frequency part. C stars. So this is what our general solution to the free Dirac equation looks like. So the Dirac conjugate of this guy there is no surprise there. So this becomes barred. This becomes starred. Our Dirac spinner is not real, so we don't have to have B and its complex conjugate there. Recall that in the case of the real scalar field, you had A and A star as the Fourier coefficient. Now we can have different Fourier coefficient, and we just write this as complex, so that later when we quantize, it'll be more convenient to interpret. So this will be the star of that. And the bar S of K. Here we have C of S of K minus I K dot X. Okay? So this is the conjugate spinner. So before we talk about quantization of the Dirac spinner, let me talk a little bit about the symmetries of the Dirac Lagrangian.
What are they subscript
again? Oh, right. So the U of S, they basically are the spinner subscript. So by U of S, what I mean is P dot sigma psi of S, P dot sigma bar psi of S, and you can choose these guys to be, say, psi 1 to be 1 comma 0, and psi 2 to be 0, 1, okay? So they tell you that the superscript S tells you the the spin state of the wave function. Okay, so so symmetries of so the Dirac theory, and I'll also mention asymmetry of the Weyl theory. So what's the Dirac Lagrangian? It's this thing. Now, because psi is a complex object, the first symmetry that pops out is that the global U1 symmetry. This is an internal symmetry. When we say internal, what we mean that we are just changing the field. We are not messing with the space-time. It's not a space-time dependent symmetry, right? And the symmetry is if you just multiply psi by some phase factor whose parameter does not depend on space-time, then psi bar should be multiplied by minus the complex conjugate of that phase. Then because, so okay, very important is that alpha is independent of space-time. Then it's obvious that this guy is invariant. So according to Noether's theorem, that means that there should be a current associated with this, right? Do you guys remember the Noether's theorem? How many of you do and how many of you don't? Just be honest. I'm not judging. No, I just want to say, I want to see whether I should like just quickly review the Noether's theorem. Should I?
Oh, you are asking whether.
Yeah, no. Now I'm asking, should I review Noether's theorem? Okay, good. So you all know. So these are the ingredients we need for Noether's theorem, that what is the infinitesimal change of our field, and what is the infinitesimal field change of the conjugate spinner. L, of course, doesn't change. And then if you plug these things into the expression for Noether's theorem, you get this current. Some people put an I there, but you know, it's up to you. This is your conserved current associated with the global U1 symmetry. So this current better be conserved. So this better be zero. And to see that explicitly, we just do a computation. And then we use here the Dirac equation. And over here, we use the conjugate of the Dirac equation. And from there we get minus, here we get so it's a very simple calculation, but I do it to emphasize that to prove that the Noether's that the charge is conserved, you have to use the equation of motion. We will see once we quantize the theory, then the conserved charge associated with this is nothing but the electric charge. Okay? So this is a theme that whenever you want to have a field describing an electrically charged or charged particle, then that field needs to be complex. And if you want that charge to be conserved, then your Lagrangian should be invariant under some kind of phase rotation. When you go and do gauge theory and standard model, you'll see that the phase rotation is generalized to non-abelian groups. Jens?
When we talk about charges, there is always redundancy, what we call positive and negative charge. And is this U1 just the complex generalization of this? And we could also say, well, let's not call it plus Q, let's call it E to the I something something. Times
Q
or something?
No, no.
So what's the significance of this U1 symmetry?
The U1 symmetry is another way of saying that we have a positive charge and a negative charge. What you call positive and what you call negative is, of course, up to you. But no, what you will see is that, that's not what you're thinking about is that, correct me if I'm wrong, you're saying that, this is a positive charge, this is a negative charge. Whether the U1 symmetry means that we can think of
that's not
the case. Noether's theorem doesn't tell you that. It tells you that there is a conserved charge, and when we quantize it, we'll get a positive charge and a negative charge. And that's related to the fact that this is complex, right? And related to the fact that we have two different kinds of coefficients now, Fourier coefficients, so that when we actually quantize the theory, this will become the annihilation operator of one particle, one kind of particle, and this will become the creation operator for another kind of particle. So you see the complex nature is related to like sneaking in two different kinds of creation and annihilation operator.
If two theories have the same gauge symmetry, like U1 for
this is not gauge symmetry.
No.
This is global U1 symmetry. A gauge symmetry, as we will discuss, will be when the U1 becomes space-time independent, dependent.
Okay.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, okay. So it's for a global symmetry like this, which appears in both Dirac equation and electromagnetism. Does it mean that like they necessarily couple to each other, or is this like more of a coincidence?
Well, we'll see that, electromagnetism doesn't have the symmetry because, as we know, photons are not charged. So there is this procedure which I will, talk about, this kind of rule of thumb, is that whenever you have a global symmetry, you probably want to ask, what happens if something happens when we gauge that symmetry? That means that you take that global symmetry and make that into space-time dependent symmetry. And many times we get interactions to make the theory invariant under gauge symmetry, and we'll see that. But electromagnetism doesn't have this symmetry because otherwise it would be charged, right? Photons. Okay. So this, the Dirac, so if we set mass equals to zero in the Dirac Lagrangian, so if we set the mass equals to zero, then we have, that Lagrangian has another symmetry, and and the symmetry is if you take psi of x to e to the power alpha gamma 5 of psi, And you take the conjugate Dirac spinner to psi bar multiplied by e to the I gamma phi from the right, then that is also a symmetry of the Lagrangian if you set m equals to 0. And the conserved charge for this is very easy to work out. And you can show that this is nothing but looks, it's an axial vector current. So there's a gamma 5 here. This symmetry is, if you start with a theory with this kind of symmetry, is broken by quantum effects. And that is hopefully something we'll see in the future sometime. Whenever a symmetry of the classical Lagrangian is broken by quantum effects, we say that symmetry is anomalous. So this theory becomes anomalous in the quantum theory.
So the neutrinos are massless in the standard model, even though we know actually in nature they're not, but in the standard model they're massless. So
right.
The classical neutrinos have a current, even though they are not charged. So we don't take quantum effects into account?
The neutrinos, there's something called the lepton number conservation. And that's a global U1 charge. So the thing about the standard model is that in the standard model, you start with some gauge symmetries, right? You impose some gauge symmetries, and you write down the Lagrangian. And then you find that the standard model has all these accidental symmetries. The baryon number symmetry is an accidental symmetry. It's a global symmetry. So is the lepton number symmetry. It's not something that you put in there by hand. It was there already because you wanted it to be invariant under the other gauge symmetries. In some of the generalizations, when you do grand unified theories, when you're adding different matters and new kinds of interactions, it turns out that some of these global symmetries will be broken, and the symmetry that you'd want to preserve apparently is B minus L symmetry. So
you mentioned that this symmetry is broken by a quantum effect. How is it after we quantize it, we no longer have this?
Right. So there are many different ways of looking at it. One is that when you add when you quantize a theory to, and you have to cancel the divergences, you have to add some, counterterms, and those counterterms will no longer, respect the symmetry. That's one way of looking at it. There are other ways of looking at it in terms of path integral, that for fermionic path integrals, the measure is no longer invariant under some transformations, this kind of transformation. So, at some point, hopefully, in the future, we'll actually treat anomalies more carefully. So, okay. So, what other symmetries do we have? So, we have, of course, the translational symmetry. Now, this is a space-time symmetry. So if we take our space, our laboratory, and move it by some amount, and let's just take epsilon to be infinitesimal, it doesn't have to be, then our spinner changes. And because we are considering active transformation, and because epsilon is small, we can do a Taylor expansion around x. So therefore, we find that now, since the Lagrangian is a scalar, by doing something analogous to this, And so putting all of this together, we find we have this current under this transformation. I'm explicitly denoting the spinner index here. So note that there are four transformations here. So we should expect four linearly independent current. And here we have the epsilon, so we can, for the coefficient of each of these guys, we get one. Okay, before we do this, we can make some simplifications. We can apply the equation of motion. And when you apply the equation of motion, you know, after a couple of steps, you can show that this actually, you know, simplifies to. This expression. So what I've done here is that because I've used the equation of motion and the Dirac Lagrangian, the way I have chosen the Dirac Lagrangian is has a factor which is the equation of motion, right? So that's good. So this term is going to drop out. And then the other term you can again, you know, use right. So, and the form of the Dirac Lagrangian that I've chosen also means this term is going to be zero, because our Dirac Lagrangian doesn't have a derivative of psi bar in it. So it's only this guy who is going to contribute. So because now we can just set each coefficient of epsilon nu to be an independent, conserved current. So we write those currents to be this thing. So here the upper label denotes that it's a four-dimensional vector, that it's a current. And the lower label refers to the fact that they're four independent of those guys. So this is known as the energy momentum tensor. So the energy momentum tensor, as I've derived here, is something that is not symmetric in mu and nu. Suppose you lower this index mu, you can see that the expression here is not symmetric in mu and nu. Right? However, in GR, you probably saw another definition of an energy momentum tensor, where the energy momentum tensor of a theory was given by the matter action and the functional derivative of the matter action with respect to the metric of spacetime. And that, by construction, was symmetric. The fact is that you can actually add things to the Lagrangian which you know, vanish on shell, which can change your energy momentum tensor and make that into a symmetric object. So it's something that you can actually turn. There's some ambiguity in defining our energy momentum tensor, and you can actually have an energy momentum tensor which is symmetric. Yes, Jens?
In general relativity, we don't have translational symmetries anyway, right? On a general curve.
Right, exactly. So
they don't even have to coincide. I mean,
they don't have to coincide. But you know, the fact that you know we are using the same name for both these things.
Oh,
so
yeah.
in some limit, you know, on some kind of background, you know, the two things should coincide in some sense. So anyway, this is not entirely, there's some ambiguity involved here. So so what we call energy and momentum in quantum field theory is actually the conserved charges associated with that energy momentum tensor. So the four momentum p nu is defined to be the spatial integral of the zeroth component of the current t mu nu. And this object is what we call the energy momentum four vector. So this is the energy momentum four vector. And the P0 part is what we'll call the Hamiltonian. So before we go for our little break, let me just leave an exercise for you. So your exercise can derive the conserved currents for the Lorentz group. So rotations and boosts also leave your Dirac Lagrangian invariant. And if you derive the conserved current for those guys, you'll find six conserved current, three of them relating to the rotation, three of them relating to boosts. And you'll see that there is the traditional angular momentum part, and there is one coming from the spin part. So there'll be three total angular momentum conservation, and there'll be three which will imply the conservation of your center of mass of your system. So before we start, I want to draw your attention to something. So I've been a bit cavalier about, you know, writing the p dependence of the spinner. So everywhere where I wrote u bar s of the, you know, p, you should think of it as the three-dimensional momentum vector. So everything here is, you know, their dependence is on the three-dimensional bit. And in these identities, that means that the three-dimensional momentum are the same. But on these two, the three momentum are opposite. The zeroth component is determined by the mass shell condition. So once we specify what the three momentum is, the zeroth component is determined. The zeroth component is taken to be the positive root of this. So let's now move on to quantization of spinners. So according to the spin statistics theorem, the Lorentz invariance of our S matrix in 3 plus 1 dimensions implies that the integer spin representations satisfy the Bose-Einstein statistics. Whereas the half integer spin representations of the Lorentz group satisfy Fermi-Dirac statistics. So one of the consequences of the spin statistic theorem is that the free particle Hamiltonians are bounded from below. Or in other words, our theory is stable. The free theory is stable. It would be a disaster if, you know, if the energy was not bounded from below. You know, we would all, you know, disappear. So, however, imposing the stability—that is, if you impose that your theory, the free part of your Hamiltonian has positive energy, is bounded from below, then that implies the spin statistics connection. So if you impose stability, or say positivity, of the Hamiltonian, of the free Hamiltonian. Okay, no, the Hamiltonian. Then that implies that the spin, the relation between spin and statistics . So if you have a theory, if you have a system which is not Lorentz invariant, such as a condensed matter system, and you want to describe that theory, you know, in some continuum approximation by some quantum field theory, you know, you would still want, you know, fermions and bosons. You would still, you know, you could still have fermions and bosons in that system, right? Then to ensure that what you're going to call fermions in that system are going to satisfy the Fermi-Dirac statistics and the scalar particles or the vector particles will satisfy the Bose-Einstein statistics, then all you have to do is to impose that your Hamiltonian is positive and the spin statistics, you know, result follows. This is useful for applications to condensed matter systems. Yeah, so the Lorentz invariance implies spin statistics theorem, but if you want the spin statistics, connection to be true for a system which does not satisfy Lorentz invariance, then you have to impose that your Hamiltonian is positive.
But the spin is still always defined in terms of the transformation property under the Lorentz transformation.
Well, if your system is not invariant under Lorentz transformation, then no. Then you. What you're calling, you know, the spin is defined in terms of the rotation group. So the spin statistics theorem is also very dimension dependent. In 2 plus 1 dimension, the spin statistic theorem implies particles with more general statistics called anions. Yes?
What do you mean by bounded from below here?
Means that its eigenvalues are not arbitrarily negative. Yeah?
Here, does it mean that we can use either the positivity of Hamiltonian or the Lorentz invariance to derive?
Right. I mean, so, okay, what I'm calling the spin statistics theorem is only the one which follows from Lorentz invariance. Over here, you know, I don't know if you'd call it a spin statistics theorem, maybe you can. It's to say that if the Hamiltonian is positive, then, you know, there is a connection between the spin and statistics.
But it need not be like a Bose-Einstein or...
No, exactly. That's a 3 plus 1 dimensions and higher. That's when it becomes both. That's why I said 3 plus 1 dimension. In 3 plus 1 dimension, it implies that it's only Bose-Einstein statistics or Fermi-Dirac statistics. And in 2 plus 1 dimension, you can have more general statistics, which is called the anion, which particles are called anions.
What if we go to a higher dimension, for example, 4 plus 1 or?
So from the discussion of 2 plus 1 and 3 plus 1, I suspect in higher dimension it'll still be Bose-Einstein and Fermi-Dirac. It's only when you go to 2 plus 1 dimension that because of topological reasons relating to how you can change particles. That you have the anionic statistics being allowed, whereas, you know, when you go to 3 plus dimensions, you know, those some of the paths you take to exchange particles can be undone in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And I don't see why they cannot be undone in higher dimension, because, you know, so I suspect that the Bose-Einstein statistics and the Fermi-Dirac statistics would be, this result would be the same for, you know, 3 plus 1 and higher. So before we delve into the details of quantization, let me just remind you how quantization works. You have some classical field, psi of x, or phi of x. So this is a scalar, and this is a spinner. And when you quantize this theory, that means that it acts on some kind of Hilbert space, a Fock space. And some people will put a hat here. To denote that this acts on some Hilbert space or Fock space. And we'll construct this Fock space explicitly. And that Fock space turns out to be an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. And therefore, that infinite dimensional Hilbert space is basically what is going to give you an infinite dimensional unitary representation of the Lorentz group. So if you make some Lorentz transformation of your system, that means that your field operator will change by some transformation matrices, transformation operators, which are infinite dimensional, and they will act on your field operator in this way. So they will depend on some Lorentz transformation matrices. And the fact that this is a scalar means that the field operator, this transformation, will leave that field operator unchanged. That's what being a scalar means. And if it's a spinner, then under that Lorentz transformation, lambda, you will have this guy. But it's a spinner, so let me put a spinner index here. It means that it'll change in this way. So we will hardly ever use the fact that, you know, these infinite dimensional, you know, unitary matrices act on these field operators by conjugation, except when we are doing stuff, for example, when we are trying to figure out the parity or the charge conjugation quantum number of our fields, of our particles, which we will do in today's tutorial, by the way. Okay, so to do canonical quantization, we will always need the momentum conjugate to a spinner. So let's define that. The canonical momentum, as you recall, is defined by this equation. When we do canonical quantization, we always choose a particular reference frame. The canonical quantization procedure is not a Lorentz invariant procedure. The Lorentz invariant way of quantizing a theory is via path integrals. However, this is not manifestly Lorentz invariant, but the underlying quantization procedure is Lorentz invariant. It's not the canonical quantization procedure is not going to be manifestly Lorentz invariant, but it'll be Lorentz invariant. The same results must hold in any reference frame. So, okay. The spin statistic theorem implies that when we are quantizing spinner fields, we must impose anti-commutator between the field and its conjugate. So that means we have to where h bar in our units is 1. So if you just, what is explicit expression for pi a, this is just nothing but in our case, this guy. So that means that our equal time commutation relationship, anti-commutation relationship is there is no I because the two I's cancel out from both sides. And all other equal time commutation relationships vanish. So I just write down the h bar to remind you that in the classical limit where h bar goes to 0, this implies that the spinner components and its conjugates and its Hermitian, in its complex conjugate or Hermitian conjugate, they anti-commute. So they are, in the classical limit, they are Grassmann C numbers or C fields. So in Dan's part of the course, you did some exercises where you took a commutation relationship for the field operators and converted that into commutation relationship for the A and A dagger, or A and B and A dagger and B dagger. So here you will have to do the same thing, except it'll be more involved because there are spinner fields, there's spinners thrown into the mix, but I've given you enough information in terms of spinner identities for you to be able to figure that out. So those anti-commutation relationships will imply these following anti-commutation relationship for the creation and annihilation operators. So all the others, such as BB, CC, or B dagger, B dagger, as well as combinations like B, C dagger. Everything else vanishes. So in my notes, which are on the wiki, I've actually kind of done the calculation where I verify that using these equations that the one of those, the anti-convergence relationship is actually, you know, does hold. So, you know, these two guys are consistent. So if you want to kind of do a calculation to kind of, you know, convince yourself these kind of things, you know, these relations do hold, please, you know, look at that calculation. So I've called these fermionic creation annihilation operators. So that means that if I construct a two-particle state and then change the two particles, then they should actually give us, those two states would be related by a minus sign. And that's easy to see, because if you have, say, if you apply two of the B creation operators on the vacuum and create a state like this, then because these two things anti-commute, this will tell you that under the, under the exchange of the first set of labels and the second set of labels, you pick up a minus sign. So what is the Hamiltonian of our theory? So the Hamiltonian of our theory is, as you know, it's given by the classical Hamiltonian is given by the Legendre transformation. So this is the Legendre transformation. Which means the time part cancels out, because you can show that the time part at the Lagrangian is exactly the same thing as this. So now using the So now we want to derive an expression for the Hamiltonian in momentum space, because the particle interpretation comes from looking at the Hamiltonian and other operators in momentum space. So that means that you take that expression for the Hamiltonian, and now you're treating it as a quantum mechanical expression, so you're not commuting psi and psi bar randomly or their components. And then you express the psi and psi bar in terms of the in terms of these guys. So you know I gave you the Fourier expansion of psi and psi bar. But now in the B and B, the B and C have, and B star and C star have become operators. And then you use the fact that these conditions hold. And you use those spinner identities to show that H is given by this expression. So this is not exactly, sorry, there's a dagger here. So this has, looks like a number operator, but this is not exactly in the form that we would like it to be. So let's use the anti-commutation relationship and rewrite this. Then we will have this guy, and we will pick up a delta function term which is formally infinite. So this is the zero-point energy associated with the field. And this is formally infinite, and we just throw it away, as you did in scalar field theory. However, before we throw it away, let's just look at the sign of this. The sign we got here is negative minus what you would have gotten in the scalar field theory. And so there are theories known as supersymmetric theories where, you know, every boson comes with its own fermion and vice versa. And when you quantize those theory because of this, you know, because of the fact that bosons you'll use commutation relationship and fermions you'll use anti-commutation relationship, the zero-point energy vanishes automatically. You don't have to normal order it in those cases. But in supersymmetric theories, you know, it actually, that, you know, this kind of quote-unquote miracle actually follows through at the interaction level where a lot of the divergences also cancel out because in the internal loop, there would be a boson and a fermion. And you'll see in the next course that they basically contribute with a negative, with a minus sign relative to each other, to the divergences.
These integrals, there should be over momentum space, right? So you wrote x, but it should be
empty. Oh yes, that's very very okay. No, thank you so much. That's horrible. It's a horrible mistake. Yeah, I wrote the right thing here, but. So this is the zero-point energy.
Maybe it is narrow convention, but do we have like 2 times E of E under the
right? Way? So yeah, that's very good. I didn't have the EP here. That's because I'm multiplying here by EP, because I expect the Hamiltonian, to have eigenvalue EP. So these guys are number operators, right? So, this will, count the number of particles, B type of particles. This will count the number of C type of particles. And so the energy would be just proportional to that. So the whole thing would be multiplied by the energy of those particles. But then for us to have Lorentz invariance, we would have to put an EP here, and these two EPs will cancel out. But if you were considering the three momentum operator, then there would be an EP here, over here, there would be a three momentum P.
When we discuss about quantization of scalar field, we also discuss about the causals on causality is how to impose causality.
Yeah, we are going to go to that next. Shortly. Maybe not in today's lecture, but definitely in tomorrow's lecture. So to formally get rid of that infinity, we need to normal order our Hamiltonian. In general, the normal ordering for spinners is defined, for fermionic particle is defined the following way. So we are normal ordering. So the normal ordering of a creation and an annihilation operator now has a minus sign. Okay, this is very important. So if you now normal order Hamiltonian, then we would not get that zero-point energy. But if you forget this minus sign while normal ordering, then you will not get the right result.
Did you forget the minus sign? Should there be a minus?
Sorry? Yes. I always forget that. Okay, so one particle states, we have already seen the two particle states. But one particle states are given by this. So this means that this state has, if you apply the momentum operator, it'll give you three momentum k. And it is in the spin polarization state s. This is a wave function, which is a spinner wave function. Under a Lorentz transformation, this will transform as a spinner. So I haven't written it, but there is a you can contract this with some the momentum space spinner to give it a spinner index. So now you can take your expression for H and apply it to this thing. And let me write the right measure this time. I want to see how this works out. And this is acting on this state. So there's an annihilation operator here. So that goes through here, picking up minus sign, but it destroys the vacuum. So this term does not contribute anything. This term has three operators. And once you use the commutation relationship, you get some delta functions. And those delta functions allow you to do the momentum integral. And once you do that, you get E of k. And similarly, if you had a particle, one particle state created by the C dagger operator, you would get the same energy. Now, it's interesting to work out what the Q operator is. And the Q operator, which is the conserved charge, is the zeroth component of our four current. And if you do this same calculation carefully, you find that there's a relative minus sign between the two number operators. So in other words, it's the difference of the B type of particle and the C type of particle. It's the difference of their numbers which is preserved, conserved. Okay? The total number is not conserved. It's a difference of the two different types of particles that is conserved. So this tells you that we have charge conservation. Of course, our theory is non-interacting. Right now, these things don't mean much. But what we want to do is that when we introduce interaction, we want this sort of these operators to have the same expressions in the interaction picture. Because when we introduce interaction and we go to the interaction picture, the interaction picture operators will continue to satisfy the same anti-commutation relationships. The other thing is that Q, of course, is not a positive definite operator. Of course, we can have a state with negative charge. So. So if you consider a state like this, then that'll give you a positive contribution to Q. But if you have a state like this, then that'll give you a negative contribution to Q. And this is really what tells us that B dagger should be thought of as a creation operator for particles whereas C dagger should be thought of as creation operators for antiparticles. We don't really care which one you call particle or an antiparticle. So often, we will write the annihilation part as psi plus so often we will do is that we will call this psi plus. Let me finish this. So now we have CR dagger of P VR of P So we sometimes write this as psi plus plus psi minus. So the psi plus is the positive frequency part. The positive frequency part contains the annihilation operators. Psi minus is the negative frequency part, and it creates the creation operators. The positive frequency part always has minus sign in front of the and the negative frequency part has a plus sign. Just this is a historical convention.
Yeah, but you can change conventions.
We can change conventions, yes, of course.
So let's change
it. So, like, let's call today's the zeroth year. Okay. Okay, same for psi bar. Okay. In the last 5 minutes or so, let's talk about causality and the Feynman propagator. So in quantum field theory, so we require the commutator of two local observables to vanish when they're space-like separated. So suppose we have some local observation observable, say OA of x. Well, let's just call it O of x. So it's a local observable. And what we want is that we want these operators to vanish if they're space-like separated. So this is what we mean by space-like separation in our convention of Minkowski space metric, which is plus, minus, 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 minus. So one way of making sure that this happens is to check that our field satisfy some similar relationship. So for scalar fields, you know, if you can, you know, determine if you can satisfy that the commutator of two space-like separated scalar field is zero if they're space-like separated, then because you're going to build up all your observables out of these guys, and you can decompose any commutator between all your observable in terms of your commutators of your scalar fields, this will be true if this is true. And you will, in Dan's part of the course, you probably saw that this was true. However, if you now take the spinner operators that we constructed and calculate what this is, for space-like separation, you find that this is not zero. However, you find that for space-like separation, the anticommutators are zero. Now, if you look at all the currents that we talked about, you will observe that all the charges and the currents are bilinear in spinners and their Dirac conjugate. So all observables in made out of spinners have this form or something like this. Let me just put the dagger here because where this is some gamma matrix stuff. Which means that if we can, because this is true, this will imply that the commutator of two observables made up for spinners will also be true, because we can always express these commutators in terms of anticommutators. And you know, this relationship will imply that observables at space-like separation are zero. So what is this object? So you can show that it's not very hard to show. You can also see it work out in Matthew Schwartz's book. That in general, not just for space-like separated, that this is given by this object, where D is so it's a distribution.
The statement here is not restricted to the free theory, right?
No, so far it is, yeah.
So far it is.
So far it is, but you know, yeah. I mean, yeah. So you'd have to couple it to something for you to be able to observe something in a free theory. That's right.
But
you can,
The fact that the psi of A and psi of B dagger has to commute for a space-like separation seems to be, I think it has the reason for the impact.
Right, yeah. I mean, that causality condition, you want that to be true for all interacting theory as well. But what I'm saying is that this particular computation, like this thing and this thing, these are all done in the free theory. But this is like more general. This has to be true for all interacting theory.
Is the show that part is also assuming?
Yeah, I mean, all this show, this is of course in the theory that we're talking about, which is so far free.
But it will be generalized to interacting.
Well, you know, in the interacting theory, we will use these things in a perturbative expansion. We essentially, an interacting theory is the free theory. We build up on the elements that we construct out of the free theory, right? Okay. Now you can show that, you know, if you have if it was space-like separated, then these two guys actually cancel out. And the way to do that is to go to a reference frame in which the time component of each of these four vectors are zero, are the same. And then apply a parity transformation on the momentum on this guy. So in this integral, take p2 minus p. And because the because the measure is invariant under p going to minus p, you can show that, those two things cancel out, but only for space-like separation. But for time-like separation, that is not zero. Okay. Okay. I will give you, because this is kind of a, there's some important subtleties associated with that and how this leads to the correct expression for the Feynman propagator. I will leave it here, and we'll come back and pick up at this point in the next lecture.